if they could lead the way.
And Abigail Disney, I wanted to ask you about Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's effort to dismantle Disney World's quasi-independent Reedy Creek district, and also about Disney's response to his "Don't Say Gay" bill. You penned a an op-ed piece in the Washington Post earlier this year on it.
Yeah, and you know what's going on there is very nefarious as far as I'm concerned. Look, Reedy Creek is not exactly the most democratic institution that we've ever heard of. It was an invention of my grandfather's in the early 1970s as a way of, you know, making financial sense out of all the needs for all the land they had down there in Florida. If I had my druthers, they wouldn't have that kind of special status. But what Ron DeSantis said was, I'm going to take away this special status, not because it's unfair, but because you've disagreed with me politically. And that is a frightening and, frankly, fascistic approach to enforcing law. And it was a message. It was a message to every other company that does business in Florida, because he said, I'm going to go after the most powerful company here in this state. I'm going to make a statement, and I bet you not one other company is ever going to cross me again. And that's exactly how it's worked out. If you look at what's happened in the aftermath, there's been total silence on the subject, on both sides. And that's because I'm sure they're locked away in a dark room somewhere working it through. Because they're really on the same page. Disney wants to make money, and DeSantis wants them to be quiet. So,
Kathleen, Bob Iger became a billionaire at the beginning of the pandemic as so many workers were losing their jobs. We have 15 seconds. Right. Your final thoughts.
It's immoral. I mean, it's just the system has gone haywire, and it, we should not have people making that kind of money while his own employees are going to food pantries to support to feed their children.
Abigail Disney and Kathleen Hughes co-produced and directed The American Dream and Other Fairy Tales. It'll be in theaters across the country on Friday. Abby's the granddaughter of Walt Disney Company co-founder Roy Disney. Here in New York, it's premiering at the opening of DCTV's Cinema for Documentary Film. And yesterday, I was at the Firehouse for the ribbon cutting. Congratulations, Abby Disney was there. You were using those scissors with John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. It was a beautiful, beautiful event. And that film will be the first documentary to air there on Friday night, again, as well as across the country. Oh, a very happy birthday to Jackie Sam. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for an associate digital editor as well as a people and culture manager. Go to democracynow.org for more information. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Commissioner candidate Renee Gonzalez is fined $77,000 for breaking campaign finance rules. The New York Attorney General will sue the Trump family for financial fraud. And A new creative project shows the impact of the Hanford nuclear site on water quality. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 21st, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. Portland's small donor elections program issued its biggest fine ever to City Commissioner candidate Renee Gonzalez. Gonzalez is challenging City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty for her seat on the council. Both Gonzalez and Hardesty are part of the city's small donor elections program, which is meant to keep big money out of politics. It gives candidates campaign money based on the small donations they get from constituents in exchange for not taking donations over $250. Candidates in the program are also not allowed to take in-kind donations, like gifts or services from businesses. Gonzalez faces a $77,000 fine for accepting and not reporting a significant in-kind donation from Schnitzer Properties Management. Wealthy property magnate Jordan Schnitzer gave the Gonzalez campaign prime downtown Portland real estate plus two parking spaces for just $250 a month. The retail rate for the space and the parking is nearly $7,000 a month, meaning the in-kind contribution was an over 95% markdown. The $77,000 fine would pay back some of the money that the Gonzalez campaign accepted from the city in the small donor elections program. It would also pay back Schnitzer for market rent in the space. The Gonzalez campaign may have an opportunity to appeal the fine or reduce its amount if they can prove that Schnitzer offered everyone the same steep rental discounts. The state of New York will sue the Trump family in a civil suit for, quote, staggering, end quote, fraud. New York Attorney General Letitia James announced that the state is filing a civil lawsuit against Donald Trump and family members. The 220-page legal filing is the result of a three-year investigation. It shows that Trump systematically overvalued his assets with the help of his family, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric Trump. Attorney General James said, quote, "We found that Trump, his family, and the Trump Organization used fraudulent and misleading asset evaluations over 200 times in 10 years on his annual financial statements. These statements were then used to obtain hundreds of millions of dollars in loans and insurance coverage," end quote. She called on the court to permanently ban Trump and his three eldest children from ever serving as officers or directors at any company in New York and from acquiring real estate in the state for 5 years, as well as paying a fine of $250 million. Trump has consistently accused Attorney General James of being politically motivated and has also claimed that the Attorney General, who is black, is racist. Politicians spar over migrant flights and border policies. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You should come visit. We have beautiful shoreline.
President Joe Biden was asked about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' threat to fly migrants to his home state of Delaware. The White House says it is working with local officials to prepare for the potential flight, which comes a week after DeSantis flew 48 migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard. House Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries slammed DeSantis and the Republican governors of Texas and Arizona, who have transported more than 10,000 migrants to Democratic cities.
They should start behaving like governors and stop behaving like human traffickers. They are putting politics over people in the most egregious way possible.
DeSantis, however, argued sanctuary cities should have to bear the brunt of what he called the Biden administration's open border policies.
Those migrants were being treated horribly by Biden. They were hungry, homeless. They had no opportunity at all. The state of Florida, it was volunteer, offered transport to sanctuary jurisdictions.
More than 2 million migrant encounters, a record, have been recorded so far this fiscal year. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin questioned what he called revenge politics amid a bipartisan attempt to block his plan to expedite fossil fuel permitting in a stopgap funding bill.
I've been around for a long time in state politics and federal politics. I've never seen stranger bedfellows than Bernie Sanders and the extreme liberal left siding up with the Republican leadership in the caucus. I've never seen this happen.
Democratic leaders and the president agreed to include the permitting package in return for his support of the Inflation Reduction Act. Former President Donald Trump's lawyers asked a federal appeals court to continue the delay of the DOJ's criminal investigation into classified documents kept at his Florida home. In a filing Tuesday, Trump's lawyers argued he had the power to assert executive privilege over documents currently in possession of the Biden administration. The judicial conference is calling for increased security for judges just a few months after the assassination attempt against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The federal court system's policymaking body also announced an extension of its pandemic-related policy, allowing for teleconferencing for civil and bankruptcy court proceedings. Charges were announced against 47 people accused of stealing $250 million from a federal program designed to provide meals for children in need during the pandemic. U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger said the defendants created a network of shell companies connected to the Minnesota-based nonprofit Feeding Our Future.
The scheme that began with a simple idea in March of 2020 grew to become the largest pandemic fraud in the United States.
Prosecutors say few meals were actually served and accused the defendants of purchasing luxury cars, property, and jewelry with the money. The FDA says it was poorly equipped to take effective action on the widespread baby formula outages this spring. In a new report, the agency points to outdated product tracking systems, inability to quickly address whistleblower complaints, and a lack of authority to address shortages. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The advocacy group Columbia Riverkeeper created an interactive story to show what a drop of water would see if it passed a Hanford nuclear site in South Central Washington. Eric Tegetoff spoke with the creators of the project.
The Hanford nuclear site on the Columbia River in central Washington has left a complex legacy for the region. An interactive story map imagines what a water droplet would see if it passed through the site to help young people understand how Hanford affects the environment. Lisa Munoz is with Columbia Riverkeeper, the group that created the story map. She calls Hanford the most contaminated place in the Western Hemisphere and a threat to the waters of the Columbia. Munoz also notes that content about Hanford hazards is most often in English, although the nearby Tri-Cities area has a large Spanish-speaking population.
So if we want everyone to have an equal opportunity to engage with the cleanup of Hanford, we really have to have clearly written materials that are accessible in their preferred language.
The Hanford nuclear site is decommissioned, but cleanup of the area will take generations to complete. Columbia Riverkeeper's story map, called Water's Walk Through Hanford, is designed for middle and high school age students. Yvonne Rivero translated the story into Spanish and says it's designed to be accessible not only to young people, but their families as well. She says the story has stuck with her.
I finished the translation over a month ago, but I cannot stop thinking about the importance of preserving our habitat, but also the pressing need for developing energy and creating energy in ways that are probably less deleterious to humankind.
Munoz says it's important for young people to know about Washington's nuclear site because they are part of the river communities that face continued risks from nuclear waste.
Hanford is a multi-generational cleanup. It's going to be there in 100 years. The future of Hanford will ultimately depend on the next generation advocating for cleanup that is thorough and just.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland lawyer John DiLorenzo has a multi-pronged approach when it comes to pushing the city to sweep homeless campers. Just 2 weeks ago, he announced a class action lawsuit on behalf of several Portlanders with disabilities, alleging that the city violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by allowing campers on city sidewalks. Now, OPB, found through a public records request, hints at further litigation from DiLorenzo on behalf of unnamed neighbors in the Laurelhurst area. The letter from DiLorenzo highlights the longstanding encampment at Laurelhurst Park, which has been a point of conflict for campers and homeowners in the neighborhood. DiLorenzo writes that the city ought to sweep the camp permanently because the trees that line the street could be faulty and could fall and injure someone. Along with the letter was a 19-page report from Pacific Consulting Arborists with judgments about the trees and bushes in the area. The clients DiLorenzo represents in the letter are unknown, but the Laurelhurst Neighborhood Association says they didn't know about the letter, which was sent out late last month. Oregon is having extraordinary trouble filling an important administrative position in the Oregon legislature. It's been more than a year since the state had a legislative equity officer, or LEO, the official who coordinates responses to harassment and retaliation complaints within the Capitol. Now the legislature is looking to outside help. Administrators have agreed to pay an East Coast recruitment firm, Spellman Johnson, up to $100,000 to help find their new LEO. The position was created after concerns arose in 2018 that people who complained about harassment, retaliation, or other bad behavior within the Capitol might not get fair treatment from the officials who formerly handled such matters. It arose in response to a sexual harassment investigation into alleged behaviors by Oregon Senator Jeff Cruz, Republican Roseburg. The LEO is supposed to have a measure of independence from politicians that legislative attorneys and human resources administrators might not possess. The office is overseen by the Joint Conduct Committee, consisting of members of both parties and both legislative chambers. Administrators posted their job opening for the position last year, but have been unable to find a suitable fit. The state has already had trouble finding and keeping a full-time LEO. The first person to take on the role in a temporary capacity, Jackie Sandmeyer, did not seek the job permanently. Sandmeyer has since been accused of lax record-keeping and ignoring complaints. Another LEO, Nate Monson, was hired after a nationwide search, moving to Oregon from Iowa. Monson resigned after just 2 months on the job when the legislature's human resources director raised concerns about discrepancies on his resume not originally noticed. Monson sued Oregon, telling Oregon Public Broadcasting, quote, "This place is crazy," end quote. The search firm billed its people as thought leaders with decades of experience managing senior-level searches and diversifying the talent pipeline. It said, quote, "We have an extensive network of leadership contacts and are uniquely qualified to conduct executive searches for government organizations," end quote. A proposal to Oregon said it filled 97% of positions it recruited for in 2020. The LEO can be the focus of extreme political pressure. Last year alone, it handled harassment complaints that led to the resignation of one legislator and loss of a committee leadership position by another. During this gap year, the legislature has instead handed the LEO responsibilities to private employment attorneys at two law firms, Jackson Lewis and Stoll Reeves. Some worry they are not always carrying out their duties. Former State Representative Diego Hernandez, Democrat Portland, resigned last year after an investigation into harassment complaints from several women. Hernandez filed a complaint of his own, accusing then-House Speaker Tina Kotek of creating a hostile work environment against him. Kotek is now the Democratic nominee for governor. Whether she broke Capitol conduct rules or not remains unclear. An investigatory report has still not been released more than 1.5 years after Hernandez's complaint, even though the investigation was said to be complete in April. Hernandez says he has not received updates on the case, despite legislative rules requiring investigators to keep parties to a complaint informed on a regular basis. The same rules suggest complaint investigations should be completed within 84 days. Kotek said she hasn't been told why the complaint against her has taken so long. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots reporter Piper McDaniel on two measures Oregonians will see on their ballot this November, the constitutional amendments Measure 111 and 112. At 6, it's When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy, with an overnight low of 59 degrees. In tomorrow's weather, those clouds may continue, with some peaks of sunshine and a high of 74. Today in history, three countries celebrate their independence days. Armenia from the Soviet Union in 1991, Belize from the UK in 1981, and Malta from the United Kingdom on this day in 1964. The quote of the day is from H.G. Wells, often called the father of science fiction, who was born today in 1866. He said, "Human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe." Alaska's indigenous communities are beginning the process of assessing the damage from Typhoon Murbach. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous communities up and down Alaska's west coast are still reeling from a historic storm that slammed into the state over the weekend. In Chivac, 136 miles west of Bethel, the Native village and the city declared a state of emergency during a joint meeting Tuesday. The emergency declaration is effective immediately and comes after the remnants of Typhoon Merbok destroyed dozens of boats people use for fishing and hunting. Many people in the Tupik community also report losing fishnets, dry houses and racks, and other gear and equipment essential to the indigenous subsistence lifestyle in western Alaska. Dozens of fishing and hunting camps miles upriver are also likely destroyed. Most people haven't had time to check yet. Residents in the village of nearly 1,000 are still advised to boil their drinking water 4 days after floodwaters from the storm inundated the community's drinking water system. The city and tribal council plan to use the community's VHF radio system Wednesday to broadcast more information about the emergency declaration and how residents can seek assistance in creating an inventory of their losses. Communities throughout the region still have weeks of work ahead to assess damages and prepare for winter freeze-up, which is only weeks away. The Alaska Native community in Anchorage is coming together Wednesday night for a fundraiser and donation drop-off site to help people impacted by the storm on the West Coast. The potluck-style event will include a silent auction and raffles. The community will be gathering donations of clothing, winter gear, boots, jackets, and canned goods. The event at the Alaska Native Heritage Center is being hosted by First Alaskans Institute, Native Peoples Action, Native Movement, American Red Cross, and the Rasmussen Foundation. The U.S. Justice Department is holding a tribal consultation in Anchorage this week on violence against women. The agency will host nearly 600 participants, including 55 tribal leaders. They'll provide recommendations to the agency on funding programs and enhancing the safety of Alaska Native and American Indian women and ways to improve access to crime information and criminal justice information systems. National Voter Registration Day was Tuesday to raise awareness of voter registration opportunities and reach voters who may not register otherwise. As Eric Tigadoff reports, a Native vote group in Montana is working to help people prepare to vote in November.
With less than 2 months to go until Election Day, efforts to ensure people can cast their ballots are ramping up. Natanya O'Neill with Western Native Voice says her group has been working in communities to check folks' registration status. She says this will make it easier on November 8th.
They have all of the information that they need. They're prepared, they've got their identification with them, and they know that they are able to vote. With the changes in the laws last year, it is a learning curve for a lot of people.
In 2021, Montana lawmakers passed legislation that affected voter registration. One measure tightens voter identification laws so that people who are registering with a voter ID, for instance, need a secondary form of identification. Another measure eliminates Election Day voter registration, requiring people to sign up to vote by the Friday before Election Day. A judge in Yellowstone County District Court has heard challenges to both of these laws and could make decisions on their legality before the November election. In the meantime, O'Neill says people should be prepared to vote in what will be a consequential election. Because of the 2020 census results, Montana will have two congressional districts for the first time in 30 years.
With the changes in the congressional seats that we've got, we need to make sure that people are aware of how much this will impact them.
Montana also is in the middle of redistricting on the state level, although maps won't be finalized until after the election. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Communities across the country are grappling with abandoned wells, minelands, and polluted brown fields and Superfund sites. A new report from the National Wildlife Federation lays out the benefits of climate restoration in these areas and what communities stand to gain. Nadia Romlagan has more with advocates in West Virginia as they assess climate restoration in their home state.
Thousands of former mines, brownfield sites, and orphaned oil and gas wells are scattered across West Virginia. A new report from the National Wildlife Federation highlights how cleaning up that land could help fight climate change. Reforesting just 25% of abandoned mine lands could potentially trap around 232 metric tons of carbon each year, according to the report. In addition to curbing greenhouse gas emissions, Angie Rosser with the West Virginia Rivers Coalition says that would help protect homes by reducing flood and landslide risks.
The better we restore those lands, the better we're protecting our communities from those types of costs and disasters.
Ongoing research points to the biomass and soil on reclaimed lands as a sink for CO2 in the atmosphere. One West Virginia study found reclaimed mine soils captured 75% of carbon within the first decade of cleanup. After it's restored, Angie Rosser says the unoccupied and once hazardous land has the potential to help diversify local economies in the Mountain State through renewable energy development and outdoor recreation and tourism.
What this comes down to is re-envisioning and transforming a community liability into a community asset.
Program Manager for Climate and Energy Policy at the National Wildlife Federation, Jessica Arians, predicts that a surge of recent funding for cleaning up degraded lands will benefit both the health of communities and the climate.
There's really historic investments coming to degraded lands reclamation. It's largely from the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed last year that has been like $21 billion for abandoned mine lands, for orphan oil and gas wells, for superfunds, and for brownfields.
The report calls on Congress to increase annual funding for National Superfund site cleanup, emergency response and removal, and brownfield redevelopment. This is Nadia Ramlagan for West Virginia News Service.
Governments and business leaders are under pressure to respond to the climate crisis and ultimately divest from fossil fuels. But consumers have a role to play in divestment as well. A new online tool gives people the ability to see where their retirement funds are invested. The project's creators say that in the long run, fossil fuel investment will ultimately cost investors. Mike Moen has more.
An online scorecard gives people with retirement accounts a glimpse into what role their investment portfolio plays in keeping the industry funded. The nonprofit As You Sow is out with its latest fossil-free funds ratings. The group's Andrew Montez says they grade investment firms based on which energy sources their funds are linked to. He adds it might not be as obvious to most account holders.
Just to use one from a major asset manager from Vanguard, within the Vanguard 500 index fund, you're going to find investments in JP Morgan Chase. JP Morgan Chase is the highest lender to fossil fuels over the last few years.
And while some of Vanguard's funds get higher grades, a significant portion received D and F grades, including its most common plans. In the past year, fossil fuel company stocks have netted returns even in a down market, but some believe the gains are short-term. Montez says his group's view is that not only do these investments contribute to the climate crisis, they could also become a more risky strategy as the world shifts to renewable energy.
What is the world going to look like if you are today a 30-year-old working at a company and you're thinking about 30 years down the road? Well, climate change has to be a major factor in what's going to impact your investments over that time.
Energy analysts say as costs for renewables like wind and solar go down, they're likely to see stronger investments. And as sources like coal see less demand, portfolios still wrapped up in those ventures could become stranded assets. On its website, As You Sow has a toolkit with guidance on how to respond to fund managers that maintain significant investments in fossil fuels. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
Energy and construction are historically male-dominated industries, but one nonprofit trains women and gender nonconforming people for green jobs. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Renewable energy and construction tend to be male-dominated fields, but an organization in Vermont is helping change that. The nonprofit Vermont Works for Women is currently running a free 7-week training that teaches women and gender nonconforming people the basics of clean energy and green construction.
When we have classes that are limited to women and gender expansive individuals, they are much more comfortable asking questions. It's a very safe space for them to be in, and it really is super empowering for them.
That's Program Manager Missy Mackin. She says participants in the Green Trailblazers program get hands-on training and work together on a small solar installation. Then they each intern with a local clean energy or green construction company.
Employers are very much looking for new folks to come into the trades. They are ready to accept a more diverse workforce. Many, many of the people working in the construction trades are retiring. And of course, renewable energy is just growing.
so she says she hopes the training gives participants the skills and confidence to pursue careers in these fields. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Instead of being a news poet, KBOO's Dan Raphael may become a news seer.
Halfway to winter, the Earth wants our attention. Hurricane in Puerto Rico, typhoon in Japan and Alaska, earthquakes in Mexico, Taiwan, flooding in Nigeria and Italy. Meanwhile, in Germany, the cataclysm is Russian pipeline closures, raising fuel costs over 1,000%, shutting down Germany's largest toilet paper company and other hot industries like bread, steel, and glass. While here in the U.S., the democracy supply continues to sputter and flare, Trump-appointed judges acting on personal delusion instead of the traditional logic and precedents, tax dollars paying to send detainees to D.C. and Martha's Vineyard. We're flooded with predictions on the weather, the economy, global collapse, but with the election just 6 weeks away, I'm afraid who the governor might be, that half Oregon's Congress folks could be Republicans. Then I forecast a blazing, unpredictable, and inflationary winter with an untraceable monkey COVID pandemic. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagan, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members,